The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
And welcome to The Divine Truth on Revolution Radio this evening with my lovely co-host Nyssa. Hi Nyssa, are you there? Hello Nyssa, are you there? Well, that's a good start. It's gone very quiet. Nyssa, are you there? I can't hear you. Andrew Johnson, are you there?
I'm here.
Oh, I can hear you. We seem to have lost Nyssa for some reason.
Okay.
Nyssa, can you just hang up and I'll try calling you again. Now, our guest this evening is Andrew Johnson. Most of you, our listeners, may know him for his investigations into the Star Child skull. Hi, Nyssa,
hello?
Are you there? Oh, you're there now.
Hello? Okay. Oh, brilliant. You can hear me. Skype's totally changed on my Android. It's updated and it looks totally different. So I don't know if it was me or if it was Skype. I don't know.
That's okay. I was just introducing Andrew. I was saying most people will know him for his investigations into the Star Child skull. But we're going to be talking about a few other topics that he's investigated this evening. And I wanted to start off really with a topic that's been of great interest to me, the secret space program. And I wonder, Andrew, if you can sort of explain to our listeners who may not know, have come across the secret space program, when did it start? What is it about?
Well, this is a topic which is fairly complex and there's a lot of disinformation that's been circulated about it, as with many of these topics. And I think, speaking personally, I've spent probably more time sorting through the disinformation than I have sorting through the information, of which there is, you know, not a lot, which is I would consider as very reliable. But the conclusion that I've come to, I mean, I got into this stuff back in about 2003 when I was looking at the UFO topic. And I think anybody that's looked at the UFO topic will have come across, you know, talk of particularly, you know, the question that comes up when we see a flying saucer, UFO, or an unusual craft, which clearly isn't a conventional aircraft. Is it one that's come from another planet, or has it come from a, you know, a secret military program? Right. And that I think is the way that people start to investigate this topic for themselves. But I think beyond that, it's difficult to get good information. But I have come to the conclusion that the public space program is actually, and has been since the early 60s, a cover for the secret space program. And the secret space program is not what is claimed by some people, but neither is the public space program what is claimed by some people. So I think, you know, you have to start thinking about, for example, if you look at the Roswell incident, which of course many people will know about, but I'll describe that just for a couple of minutes, maybe just to kind of set the scene.
Okay.
Because I think the genesis of the secret space program, I would say, was following the Roswell crash, and that happened in 1947, I think, as you mentioned to me very briefly just before you know we started recording here and coming on air. You've been to a Roswell 70 event organized by Ben Emlyn Jones.
That's right. Yeah.
That was in commemoration of this event, which happened in July 1947, at actually the place where the crash took place was Corona, and that's documented in Stanton Friedman's book, Crash at Corona. I think that was one of the earliest books. And Stanton Friedman started investigating the case in 1978, following him accidentally bumping into Jesse Marcel, who was an intelligence officer at the Roswell base, which I think was the 509th Bomber Squadron, if I've got the number right. And Jesse Marcel was sent out to investigate Mac Brazel's ranch, and where there was debris scattered over a large area. The sheep wouldn't go near it. And debris was then collected over a period of probably several days or even weeks and taken back to Roswell base. And various people there saw this debris. We have a number of witnesses to what happened there. Again, you know, you sometimes get a bit of conflicting stories, but there is a lot of consistency in the stories as well, in that some bodies were recovered, debris was recovered. A particular thing that interests me and many others is the so-called memory metal, where you have this foil-type material, and you scrunch it up into a ball and then open your hand and it would be perfectly flat again. It was almost like some type of advanced silver foil. And there are several witnesses to this. A recent one which I came across was Jerry Croth, who's a psychology professor or doctor. He's in his 70s now, and he was shown a piece of this material in about 1965 by one of his students either at the school or at the university he was teaching at. And so that's one of these materials. I bring that up because this was a very unusual material. It had these memory properties. You couldn't cut it, you couldn't drill through it, you couldn't burn it, yet it was extremely thin. It was almost like a metallized cloth. So what was with this material? And so if this material was indeed taken from the Roswell debris and then taken to private companies, I think there is some suggestion that may have been developed as part of a special type of material that was used in the following development, which ended up being a secret space program or part thereof. Many testimonies from Roswell. Obviously, I won't talk about that too much, but I do urge people who are not familiar with the case to investigate it. And I think a good starting point, even though it's partly fictionalized, is the Paul Davies film made in 1991, a TV movie simply called Roswell, which I think is an excellent overview of the events and made in a very compelling manner. So where do we go from there? Well, I think what I talk about next is looking at the normal aerospace industry. For example, if you go back and look at various magazines and various literature in the 1950s, particularly in the times when flying saucer sightings were becoming quite prevalent, particularly in the USA, and we had a number of books written, such as Frank Scully's book, which I've only recently read, actually called Behind the Flying Saucers. That was written in 1950. Even in that book, there are hints that, there's already a secrecy apparatus has been constructed to take some of the findings about the flying saucers and use them to military advantage. And then you had other books, such as Major Kehoe's book, Flying Saucers Are Real, I think. I get the title of his book mixed up with George Adamski's book. But Major Kehoe's book is also very interesting. So what were the US military in particular doing with the information from these saucer sightings and with indeed these alleged crashes, of which there were several? Roswell wasn't the only one. If you accept that these craft did come down, then what happened to whatever was collected? You know, that's the question in my mind. Did they just leave it there? Well, clearly they didn't, because whatever they found, they took away. And a number of testimonies, again, from Roswell say that much of the material was taken to Wright Field, which is now Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. So there was that. And as going back to the aerospace industry, they're all talking about having anti-gravity propulsion. Most of the main aerospace companies in the 50s, as Nick Cook writes in his book, The Hunt for Zero Point, were openly talking that, you know, in the sort of 20th century, the late 20th century, we'd all be having Jetson-type flying cars, you know, because they'd work on anti-gravity. Curiously, most of the aerospace companies stopped talking about anti-gravity propulsion in about 1955. It all kind of switched off then, as if somebody had flicked a switch. And Nick Cook suggests that that's when it went black and the companies really had started to work in secret, or, you know, with the Defence Research Agency or whatever it was called back then. It's called DARPA now. Then they started to develop this technology. And right. Then if you go from 1955, it's only a short jump to 1957, which, of course, many listeners will hopefully know that that was the start of the public space program, the launch of Sputnik from Soviet Union, which orbited the Earth, I think, only two or three orbits or 10 orbits or something, which was just simply a small radio transmitter. Was that just a distraction? Did they already have more advanced technology by then?
Did the Russians have similar technology? Did they have their own sort of anti-gravity technology as well? I'm assuming that there were crashes also in Russia.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know much about the Russian scene because, of course, at that time there was not many people got to know what was going on in Russia because of the regime. But yes, there are certainly rumours, and you may have watched the same YouTube documentaries as I have, you know, the Russian UFOs and this sort of thing. And it's quite possible that, yes, they did have crashes and they did have their own space program, secret space program. So what I think you go to next, in what I've spoken about at least, is 1961, which of course was allegedly the launch of the first man in space, Yuri Gagarin. But if you look at David Percy's video, which is called What Happened on the Moon, there is a segment in that about 10 minutes long, where they investigate the Yuri Gagarin launch.
Yeah.
And it appears that the footage of the Gagarin preparation for his launch was not filmed when they said it was filmed. It was pre-filmed partly in a studio, partly with a lighting rig. And if you look at the record of the launch sequence for Gagarin, there was a break in the launch sequence of 45 minutes. And then they went and moved the gantry back to the rocket. They apparently had to mess with the hatch on the capsule. And then the launch was resumed, and allegedly off Yuri Gagarin went into space. But it was revealed in 1999, and I saw this in a BBC program, actually, around that time, that Yuri Gagarin didn't land in the capsule. He actually parachuted out of the capsule. And that's according to the official record. And so certain people had questioned whether he really did set a record for the first manned space orbit, because he landed by parachute. He didn't land in his capsule. So if you put two and two together, was it indeed that the capsule went up empty and they actually took Gagarin out from the craft because they needed to make sure he survived so that they could claim a victory? And they flew him off in a plane for, you know, an hour, a couple of hours or whatever, and then he jumped out of the back of the plane and landed in somebody's field, or they landed it near where the capsule came down. And that was the recorded events. And there was also some other testimony where a man, I forget his name, it's in the David Percy clip. He was in Russia. He heard the Gagarin launch had taken place, and then he was traveling back to Britain, I think, and he got to further towards Britain, I can't remember, like East Germany or something, and he heard a news broadcast of the Gagarin launch taking place live, yet he'd already heard the report the previous day. So he became suspicious immediately that there was some skullduggery going on, and that was reported in a newspaper as well. So what I'm saying is that we already have some evidence that the public space program was not as it was claimed to be. And, of course, you know, people might respond to me, well, Andrew, you know, that was the Cold War. You know, so the skullduggery was just to do with the Cold War, the struggle of communism versus capitalism and all of that stuff. But I think there's more to it than that. And so you have to go really, I think, to the Apollo program. And I've been looking at that since, again, about 2004 and 2005 sort of time period. And I realized in 2005, and I was quite upset when I did realize this, that there was no possible way they could have, got to the moon as claimed. They couldn't have done it.
Is that based on the technology that they had at that time?
Well, essentially, yes. But I mean, but there are many problems. I think one of the ones that I came across a little bit later, which to me cannot be explained, is this photograph which is in the Apollo record of Charlie Duke's family, which is from Apollo 16. Apparently, the folklore of NASA goes that Charlie Duke, who was one of the astronauts on that mission, took a family picture, you know, just an ordinary one that you'd have in a photograph album. He put it in a clear plastic bag and left it on the surface of the moon. And you can see this clearly in one of the documented NASA pictures, which is in NASA's library. You know, you can access it on NASA's website, and I've checked, and the picture is there. But the problem with this picture being on the moon's surface is that the average temperature is 100 degrees centigrade. That's the average temperature. When you've got, you know, full sun on it, temperature gets to well over 100 degrees centigrade. Yet this plastic bag and this photographic paper, which is ordinary photographic paper, isn't curled up. It isn't deformed in any way. And you try that, you know, you try getting a photograph and putting it on a hot plate, and you'll see that it will curl up because of the way that the paper is made, and the plastic bag will crinkle up and melt in that sort of heat. It may not melt into a brown blob, but it would certainly deform and melt, and this picture shows none of that. So that right there, that single picture alone, I would say, proves that the Apollo missions were not as claimed. They cannot have been claimed. That shot was taken in a studio. And there are many other anomalies. You know, many other people have talked about the shadow lengths and the shadows going in different directions. Some of that stuff, I think, is correct, and some of it I don't think is doubtful. I don't think you can prove it one way or the other. Highlight some of that in a presentation I do.
So what do you think happened with the Apollo moon landings? I mean, did they actually launch men into space? Did they just orbit the Earth and come back?
I think that's what basically happened. I mean, again, if you read Bill Kaysing's book, We Never Went to the Moon, he tells of an account of one of the Apollo capsules being pushed out of the back of a C-130 plane. There was a witness to that, apparently. So that would tend to suggest they didn't even go into orbit. I'm not quite sure about that, but I think they did go into orbit, possibly. There is a particular film by Bart Sobrel called A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Moon. Yeah. And in that film, you will maybe have seen that they show this. He shows this clip of them faking a shot of the Earth. It's quite clearly what they are doing. They are faking a shot of the Earth, and trying to make it look as if they are much further out from the Earth than they are, and they put in a little insert to make the Earth look like a crescent rather than a large globe, which is, you know, just outside the window. So that's another problem with the official Apollo record. Many, many problems. So, you know, why did they need to fake the Apollo space program? That's the question you must ask. Was it really just to, you know, say that we were better than the Russians, the US system, the capitalist system, and the West system was better than the Russian system, and, you know, we were better technologically than what they were, and we had freedom, so we could do anything like landing men on the moon? Or was there something else going on? And if you take the Gagarin story, that Gagarin wasn't the first man in space, that was just another ruse, then the Russians and the Americans must have colluded on keeping each other's secrets. In other words, the Russians didn't, you know, grass on the Americans not going to the moon, and the Americans didn't grass on the Russians not being the first, you know, mission as claimed. So yeah. This then would tend to suggest, I know I'm you know, sort of skipping over a lot here, but this would tend to suggest there is something else going on. Okay. And, you know, again, if you start to look into some of the Disclosure Project witnesses, for example, such as Mark McCandlish, who testified at Stephen Greer's press conference in 2001 and has told the same story ever since, that he was given information about the so-called ARV, the Alien Reproduction Vehicle, which was a flying saucer type of craft. And he was given a description by his contact, who was called Brad Sorensen, I think. And there is a quite an interesting video you can find about this, which I think is called the Flux Liner, because that was the other name for it. Some technical details are given about this craft. And Mark McCandlish also has a photograph which was taken in the 1960s sometime. And he claims that this photograph shows a very similar shape to the alien reproduction craft that he was told existed in 1988, which his friend saw at an air show at one of the air bases. I can't remember which air base it was, but this was a special air show which was given to certain select individuals from government and military.
I've heard about this. Yeah,
right.
There was a flying saucer there that was able to be viewed by a certain person.
Correct. And it was, I think the story goes, according to Mark McCandlish, that this thing was, you know, hovering 3 feet off the ground or something. Mm-hmm. That his friend saw it.
Was this an alien craft, or was it a back engineered craft?
Well, the impression I got from the story was that it was back engineered, and it had been in existence for quite some time. I think when I heard the longer account of this, which I think was given in Mark McCandlish's Flux Liner video, when his friend saw this, I think he saw it fairly close up, you know, from 20 or 30 or 40 feet away, something like that. This thing looked quite old, you know, it looked as if it had wear and tear and rust and scratches on parts of the structure. So that led him to believe that this thing wasn't new. It was maybe 10, 15, 20 years old, which then, of course, takes us back into the 60s. So we have that story, I think, has some credibility to it. I don't buy these more recent stories of people like Corey Good and Captain K and these people. They're just anecdotal. They don't have any solid evidence that I'm aware of to back up their stories. I mean, they seem to believe their stories, you know, and just as the Apollo astronauts seem to believe their stories. But I don't think there's any evidence to back up the stories of Corey Good that I'm aware of.
In the 40s and 50s, they took craft such as the Roswell craft. They back-engineered them to create their own UFO, their own anti-gravity craft, and they kept all of this a secret from the public. And then they developed this into what we would call the secret space program. And they developed that side by side with the public program, the NASA program. And they used the NASA program basically as a cover. So all of the, a lot of the money that was supposed to be funneled into NASA was going into the secret space program. Is that pretty good analogy of what was going on?
That's what I think was going on, because, you know, a lot of people still talk about the Apollo program, even, you know, UFO researchers. And, you know, I've actually had a conversation with somebody quite recently in the last week about this. They still believe the Apollo program was real, and they went to the moon in those craft. And yeah, so that's exactly it. The proportion of the money was siphoned off into black programs and secret developments, and many of the good scientific minds, you know, of that time that were thinking about space travel were taken off, you know, thinking about anti-gravity propulsion and so forth. Chemical rockets was their way to go, and you know, they were all focused on that, and it worked. And I was fooled. You know, I watched the thing when I was 4 years old. I never even questioned its authenticity until 2005, I think it was, when I really started to question it. So
I still can't believe that in 2017 we're still using rocket technology from the 40s to send people into space.
That's exactly it, and this is what people don't cotton on to. And another thing I posted in this discussion with a couple of people on Facebook last week was a very interesting series of articles that's been written over 3 years. It's on David Percy's website. It's been in Nexus magazine. It's a series of three articles by a PhD guy who has a pseudonym that he uses called Phil Coutts. I recommend people read these articles, because what he does is he goes through the more recent NASA documentation, which was trying to do a reboot of the manned space program. And there have been two runs at this. The first one started in 2003, I think it was, or 2004. I may have got the date slightly wrong. But it's when George Bush announced the the USA Constellation program, which was meant to take men back to the moon and back to Mars. And there were so many, you know, millions invested in feasibility studies. Documents were produced from that. They projected that they weren't going to put on the man on the moon until 2020. That's 16 years after the start of the program. So how did they do it in 8 years in the 60s?
Yeah.
And then essentially in 2010, Obama did another version of that. He chopped and changed things, and they were going to have the Constellation program, it then became. And they said they didn't need to go back to the moon. They were just going to go to Mars. But they didn't really have any planned vehicles. There's been a thing recently where they've developed a new capsule. And there was quite a bit of fanfare about 18 months ago when this NASA engineer said they hadn't worked out how they were going to get through the Van Allen zone safely.
Yeah, I heard about that.
Yeah, and you probably heard about that.
All these programs seem to be ignoring the moon now, and everyone's looking at Mars.
Yeah,
Elon Musk is, you know, sending people to Mars, and, you know, Mars is now the big, you know, we wouldn't need to get to Mars for some reason. I don't know why we need to get to Mars.
Well, indeed. I mean, this to me is probably another distraction, but it's, you know, you cannot deny, no one can deny, that the US manned space program ended in 2011. That's 6 years ago. And they're all taking the people up to the space station from Baikonur, Cosmodrome. Mm. So, you know, it's just a joke for those that are interested in manned spaceflight. There is nothing that's – the technology has been static for 50 years, basically. Actually getting – you know, the rocket technology, as you say, has been pretty much static for a further 10 years or even longer.
Do you think we have been to the moon, the Mars, and maybe beyond using the secret space program?
Well, I think it's highly – likely. I think it's hard to get reliable information. One of the interesting testimonies that I find is Carl Wolf's testimony, again from the Disclosure Project. He's somebody that doesn't seem to have tried to make anything out of his testimony. He hasn't embellished it. He doesn't, you know, go into lots of other stories or anything. He just gave his testimony. In 2001, I was shown photographs of a base on the backside of the moon, and he took, you know, that as being a, I took that as being an honest report, and I think that there are some anomalies on the moon which may be explainable by stuff being there. You know, the other thing I talk to people about a little bit is transient lunar phenomena, which I first learned about in about 1986, where people that are just observing the moon with an ordinary telescope, they've seen clouds of gas, you know, coloured vapour, objects flying across, you know, wherever. And these have got the name transient lunar phenomena because they don't last long. And there was a report published before the moon landings about such things. I think even Patrick Moore assisted in this report. And it's you can access it. I think it was written in about 1967. And they discovered, I think, 560 things which they couldn't really identify on the moon. They were looking for landing sites. And it's an interesting report as well. You can probably get hold of it. Well, I downloaded it a while ago now, but I've forgotten most of the details. But that's worth looking at as well.
I spoke to I had John Lear on my show a few months ago.
Oh yes,
he's probably one of the most decorated pilots in history, and he was talking about some photographs that he obtained in the 60s from NASA. These are undoctored; you can't get these photographs anywhere these days, and they clearly show, you know, bases and construction, or what you could call constructions on the moon that are not, you know, natural. You know, like right angles and shapes that are not natural. They don't appear naturally on the moon.
And I think John has also got some pictures of what he thinks are mining operations on the moon. I think that was on his website one time, which is called livingmoon.com. Mm-hmm. He's got quite a lot of stuff on there, and you know, I have exchanged the odd email with John, because he got involved with our 9/11 investigation at one time back in 2008. And I think he, some of what he says is pretty way out stuff. You know, another of the stories that he talks about is they've got this, it sounds unbelievable, you know, I'm sort of chuckling slightly, but for heck, you know, it might even be true for all I know, but they've got this enormous tower on the moon which has a large box on the top of it, and he calls it the soul catcher, where they capture these souls. I don't know if you've heard that story. It's a pretty bizarre story.
I've also heard about the planet-sized mirrors they have in space that sort of hide planets. You can hide entire planets using these mirrors.
I haven't heard that one.
These massive mirrors. Yeah, it's hard to believe a lot of the stuff that could, you know, I mean, to be honest, even if you can believe in the secret space program, I suppose you could believe in a lot of the hidden technology that's being used.
Well, this is it, you know, and I mean, there are other rumours, like Ben Rich, for example, you know, saying they had the technology to take E.T. home. He said that in 1993.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's a fairly reliable account, because I think there are several witnesses to Ben Rich saying that at this lecture. And I think the one, I can't remember the name of the guy who heard him say that, but he's head of MUFON now, isn't he, this guy, one of the branches of MUFON. But yeah, so there's a lot of stories like that. And again,
have you heard about the that British computer hacker who
Gary McKinnon? I met Gary McKinnon. Yes.
Yeah, he found some documents.
Correct.
To military personnel who were space based and craft that had space designations rather than, you know, like
a right.
Do you credence to that?
Well, certainly Gary is, as far as I'm concerned, is a totally honest witness. I spoke to him for several hours back in 2006, and I've listened to him since. Richard D. Hall interviewed him probably a year or two ago now, and that's also worth watching. And when I listened to Gary's description of what he did, you know, in terms of the technicalities of what he did, using this software called Remotely Anywhere and downloading files and whatnot, it seemed totally accurate to my way of, you know, I know a little bit about accessing machines remotely and this sort of thing. I haven't really done any hacking like Gary has, but I do have a fairly good technical knowledge of such things and how such things might be achieved, because my background is in software engineering. So I think his story is true, but there is some talk that what he may have discovered was an actual spreadsheet file, because he said it was an Excel spreadsheet that he discovered, where somebody was playing a computer game, and these designations were actually designations in a computer game. You know, it was like one of these games like Homeworld or something, which is one of these PC games where you fly off into space and manage a space fleet and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But you know, again...
But why was there so much interest from the security services in deporting him?
Indeed. So that's what you've got to ask yourself. But I think Gary has probably did stumble on something that was, you know, sensitive. And this phrase of non-terrestrial officers as well, I've never heard that in any computer game or anything like that. That was the key phrase that he used.
Yeah.
You know, and ship-to-ship and fleet-to-fleet transfers is what he talked about. So some very interesting stuff, and I think he was being honest in his reporting of what he found. So I think that is sort of scanty evidence that they, you know, they do have records of stuff that's going on.
He did have names as well, didn't he, of the officers involved, the off-world officers. Well, he had names as well to verify it.
I think there were some names. I think he had the names of ships. I can't remember if he said he had the names of officers. I definitely remember him saying he had the names of ships, which he couldn't identify as any normal Navy or, you know, Air Force ship or anything like that. But I don't think it had the names of any officers, or if he did, he couldn't remember them, because he didn't save this spreadsheet. He didn't write it down. He was just cruising around the place. You know, he wasn't taking detailed notes. He took a lot of stick for that, but I think he was telling the truth. He was just, because he said he was smoking dope and things while he was doing it, so he was perhaps not in the best state of mind, even though he was in a good enough state of mind to do what he did.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, Andrew, if you know anything about, there's this new technology which Germany's coming out with, which is to do with protecting us from the sun. And it looks like it's like hexagrams, which is supposed to reflect the sun, or the sun comes through it. And it kind of sieves the sunlight through, and it's all over YouTube, people videoing mostly solar flares, saying that it's the fake sun and things like that. But I did see a news article from a German technological company, which they have actually developed the technology. I'm not sure if they've deployed it yet or not, but it was to do with the sun protecting us from certain rays from the sun.
I know I haven't really heard anything about that, so I don't know exactly why they would need that. Do you know what the application was meant to be? Was it for health, or was it for energy, or?
It's supposed to be protecting us from the rays as they become more intense, basically just weakening it out as it hits us. Okay. It's a shame I haven't got the article with me, but... Okay. Yeah, I just wondered.
No, I haven't really heard of that particularly. Going back to some of the other aspects that I come across, the biggest one that I haven't mentioned was the disclosures of Edgar Fouché, who has quite recently passed on, sadly. And I spoke to him at great length and got to know him quite well. And he, to me, was a 100% legitimate witness and also very knowledgeable, and I did 5 hours of interviews with him, which are on my YouTube channel, which is called Disclosing Secret Technologies. And he actually can prove from documents that he had in his possession that he worked in Area 51 at the Nellis Air Force Base, which is the other name for it, or parts of Nellis Air Force Base are in Area 51. And he worked there in 1979 on what's called temporary duty. And he had a reason for going there, which was to go and take up a job that needed to be done while somebody else had had to take leave for a bereavement, to deal with a bereavement. And he reported being in this secret communications facility where he was testing a communications board, which he pulled out of a rack, and he was using test equipment such as an oscilloscope and a frequency meter. This is how I'm pretty sure he was telling the truth, because the terminology he was using was all correct. And he actually pulled this board out. This, we're talking in 1979, and he looked at the test points. He put this oscilloscope on them, and he found that this board had a processor on it, which was running at a frequency of 1 gigahertz. Which was, we didn't get 1 gigahertz processors until about 20 years later in the white world. And it was very advanced electronics that he was dealing with. And he also couldn't go into the next room where this rack actually was connected to. He had to do this all through intermediaries. You know, there was compartmentalization between the place where he was set to work and the place where he needed to get to complete the testing. So he explained all of this in some detail to me. It's all in the interviews if you want to go and listen. And he also had to go into underground facilities as well. He described working in one or two of these. And he worked in many secret facilities and a number of black programs, mainly with fighter aircraft. And he was his specialism was in cryptographics, which is, you know, keeping code secret and encrypting signals so that they're not subject to interception or faking, or there is, you know, electronic countermeasures, this sort of thing. And over his work in various projects over about 20 years, he got to know people, and he was given certain information, and over time he came to understand that they had a secret aircraft. Well, they had actually a number of secret aircraft, and he talked about these in a presentation at the International UFO Congress in 1998, and that you can find that on YouTube. And if people haven't seen that, I recommend they watch it, because I think the information in that presentation, it's very dense, somewhat technical, but to me it has all the hallmarks of being 100% authentic. And he spoke in that presentation of an aircraft which he thought was called the TR-3B, which was this triangular-shaped craft. And it operated on the principle of MFD, which stands for magnetic field disruption. And this technique, or this technology, uses a very powerful magnetic field to actually affect gravity, and the result is that the ship has an 89% weight reduction and can then fly at very, very high speed. I think something like 8 times the speed of sound in the atmosphere, and it can hover silently for, you know, indefinitely. And he actually said that he'd seen these craft twice. I think once he said he saw them when he was doing a sort of desert motorbike run with his buddies, a couple of his buddies, they're on motorbikes, and one of these triangular craft flew over him. And the next was actually when he was in Area 51 in 1979. He said he saw one of these things landed on the tarmac, and he described this to me in the interview that he did with me. And also what he said during the bit I did missed out from before was that when he was looking at this communications equipment and he was testing it, one of the things he picked up was that they were sending a voice signal up into space, which was quite unusual because they didn't have anybody in space in 1979. The Skylab had finished, and it was before the space shuttle. So he wondered who they were talking to up in space using this equipment. And he says that in the interview.
Right.
So the other thing which made me think it, well, the number of things which made me think his story was authentic was that the technology which he described, having a rotating plasma, which is super cooled, that if you look at the physics of it, appears to be, according to one way of looking at it at least, a very good way of generating a very powerful magnetic field, you know, millions of times stronger than you would get if you ran a magnetic field through a coil of copper wire, you know, because you've got to have many, many windings to increase the strength of the field. But if you can use a mercury-based plasma, as he was saying, which is a metal, obviously, and you rotated this at, I think, 50,000 revolutions per minute, and it was highly pressurized as well, to so many thousands of atmospheres. This appeared to stack up technically from what checking Richard D. Hall, who was an engineer, and I did. And also this mercury is something which comes up because there is talk of mercury being used in the German Bell experiment, which was this alleged secret weapons program which happened towards the end of the Second World War,
yeah,
by Hammond Kamler.
That's
covered in Nick Cook's Hunt for Zero Point book to some extent.
Igor Witowski has done a lot of research on that.
That's right. So that appears to have another link there to the mercury issue, which, and then the other place that I came across the mercury link was in the discussion of the Vimanas in this Vimanaka Shastra, which David Hatcher Childress talks about.
Yeah.
And in that booklet, which apparently was found in 1905 or something, or written in 1905, but the problem with that material was that it was channeled. It wasn't one of the original Vedic texts. It was one which was channeled around that time in the early 1900s. But nevertheless, it's unusual that this channeled text would talk about anti-gravity propulsion, you know, being based on some type of mercury or mercury compound or something. That's very unusual.
Yeah, we're going to go to break in about 5 minutes, but
okay.
There's one question that most skeptics would ask you is that if there is a secret space program, why there's going to be like thousands of people involved in such a program? Why have not more people come forward to give their stories? I mean, you have people like Bob Lazar, you know, and others who claim to work in Area 51, but why have more people not come forward to say that they worked on these craft?
Well, I think the simple answer to that is there are severe consequences for those that speak out. For example, even Edgar Fouché, he had his house broken into, he had his car broken into, he had his hotel room broken into when he was at this conference. And I think certain threats were made to him. So, you know, there are only a few people that will actually be prepared to speak out when those threats have been made. These people are under the strictest oaths. You know, pain of death appears to be the situation. But of course, yes, I mean, Bob Lazar is another one. There are certain question marks over some parts of his story. But Bob Lazar, again, appears to be a very gifted and intelligent chap. He even designed a different type of hydrogen fuel car back in the 1990s, I think he designed it. Nothing to do with secret space technology. I've used that video about that in a couple of presentations I've done. And he appears to be, you know, he built his own particle accelerator. He appears to have the technical and, mechanical expertise to do such things.
Mm. I guess it's when people like this come out, they're either discredited or called liars or, you know, that type of thing, isn't it, really?
Right.
That's the problem with people coming forward.
I think they also have ways of introducing disinformation into these seemingly credible stories, like, for example, the Bob Lazar story. He talks about element 115. Yeah. No, I don't think that part of the story is true. I don't think it stacks up that you would have an advanced propulsion system powered by this element 115. Now, it's true that element 115 didn't exist when Bob Lazar told his story, and it now they have managed to synthesize it, but they've only synthesized about 6 atoms of it, which and it lasted for, you know, 10 nanoseconds or something. You can read about that in the various university websites if you want. So it's hardly enough to, power a flying saucer's propulsion system. So I think that is disinformation. And it's even possible that Bob Lazar was messed with to make him believe that that story was true, as indeed it appears that the astronauts were messed with. Particularly in the case of Edgar Mitchell, for example, is a prime example of somebody who has been embraced by the UFO movement as some kind of, saviour, when clearly the guy has not been totally honest. Edgar Mitchell, I'm talking about, not at all honest, in fact.
Yeah, but that goes into a whole new topic of, you know, things like mind control and
MKUltra
and things like that. I'm sure most of the astronauts probably did go under some kind of mind control because they never really gave a straight answer to any question, really. I know Neil Armstrong never really gave an interview, and then I believe ever seen one interview where he sort of avoided most of the questions to relate to the moon landing and what they saw on the moon. He sort of like, you know, he would try to change the subject or didn't really answer the question directly.
Right.
He didn't say, I did this or I did that. He said it in a third person. So he answered all the questions in a third person sense, which gives the impression that he was lying, in my opinion.
Right, that's it. I mean, this is something Richard D. Hall has recently analysed in his tour, and he did the Peter Hyatt analysis. But we can talk more after the break.
Yeah. Okay, we're just going to a break, and we'll be back in a few minutes with Andrew Johnson. Thanks.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates. You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
And welcome back to The Divine Truth on Revolution Radio with my guest this evening, Andrew Johnson. Before we continue with the show, I'd just like to remind you that Revolution Radio is a listener-supported station. We do rely on your donations to keep us on air. So please do go to freedomslips.com and go to the supporter section where you can make a one-off donation or you can join our monthly support club where you can make a monthly donation starting at only $10, or you can join... Or you can buy one of our seed packs that start at only $60. All of our seed packs contain non-GMO, non-hybrid heirloom seeds and start from $60 up to $200. So please do go to freedomslips.com to the supporter section and make a donation if you can. Also, before we continue with the show, I'd just like to announce my conference, which is being held in the UK. In November, it's the weekend of November the 11th and 12th, as well as our guest this evening, Andrew Johnson, who will be speaking there. We also have my other lovely co-host, Sarah Adams, who will be talking there, as well as Christine Hart, Tony Topping, Thomas Sheridan, Maria Wheatley, David Shaler, Kathy Morgan, Carl James, and Ben Emlyn Jones. That's the AwakeOn conference, the weekend of Saturday, November 11th, and Sunday, November the 12th. and that's in Medstead, Hampshire, in the UK. Please go to awakeon.com for more information. And we'll continue with the show. Andrew, are you still here?
I'm still here.
Hi. Nyssa, you haven't disappeared again, have you? Nyssa? I can't hear you again, Nyssa. I hear a clicking noise, but I can't hear you. Do you want to hang up again and I'll call you back again, Nyssa?
Hear me now?
Oh, I can hear you. Oh, yeah.
Oh, can you hear me now?
I hear you now, yeah.
Yeah, oh, sorry. I had to plug it in, out and in again. It's Skype. Sorry.
Oh, you've got a dodgy headset.
I don't know. I don't know what it is. It's frustrating. Anyway, don't let that distract us.
What were we talking about just before we went to break?
We're talking about Edgar Mitchell, actually.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Do you want to go ahead with what you were saying about Edgar Mitchell?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's I become very frustrated at times because Edgar Mitchell is one of these people who initially comes across quite well. He's been seen as a person who's disclosed the truth or helped try and disclose the truth about UFOs because he made these statements about being aware of the Roswell crash and knowing people that were involved as witnesses and this sort of thing. And he said, oh, yes, you know, he's been in touch with people in the government who, you know, said there were crashed flying saucers and stuff. But when you actually start to dig a bit deeper, the picture becomes a lot more murky with Mitchell. And there is a film called Astronauts Gone Wild where Bart Sobrell asks Mitchell to explain the footage that was shot in Apollo 11, allegedly, where they've got this distant shot of the Earth. I mentioned this footage earlier in the program.
Yeah.
And Mitchell initially is a little bit, you know, uncomfortable, but then he gets sort of quite aggressive and asks Sobrell to leave and says that Sobrell had, you know, come to his house under false pretenses, which is sort of partly true, I suppose, you know, so I can sort of partly accept that. Then as Sobrell is leaving the property, Mitchell's son says, shall we call the CIA and have him waxed? And that's on audio, you know, they've got essentially that on camera.
Yeah.
And Mitchell talks about shooting him as well. And then there is another bit of history with another person called Bruce De Palma, who was a free energy device designer, invented the N machine back in the 1980s. And De Palma has also been interviewed and said that Edgar Mitchell came to see him in the 1980s and offered him some money for this N machine prototype, which Bruce De Palma declined. And then Bruce De Palma said that Mitchell said to him, if you're going to go doing things like this in Southern California, you're going to get your head blown off. That is clearly a very strange thing for Mitchell to go around saying to Bruce De Palma. And then further to that, there is another situation which came to light in 2013 when Edgar Mitchell was interviewed for a documentary called The Secret Life of Uri Geller. And if you access the full 90-minute version of that documentary, you will hear that Mitchell actually admits that he was working for the CIA in the 1970s. And he reported to George Bush, who was the head of the CIA in the 1970s. When you put those things together, and I've got this all in an article on my website, checktheevidence.com, if you want to go and read it, this guy is a nasty piece of work. And yet people are still lauding him, you know, and saying what a terrible thing it was when he passed away and so forth, and you know, didn't get a chance to disclose anything more. But he's another person, one of many that I've come across, who is another Pied Piper, is leading people in down a false alleyway and into nowhere. So that's a little bit about Edgar Mitchell and his non-disclosures about the secret space program.
Okay, I want to move on to our next subject. I want to talk about Planet X next. There's a lot of disinformation out there about Planet X, what it is, where it comes from, who lives on it, and all this kind of stuff. So do you want to just, like, give an outline of, firstly, what is Planet X? Is it like a dwarf sun? Is it another? Is it a planet, or is it something else?
Right. Well, of course, people will be aware. I think some listeners, at least, will be aware of Zechariah Sitchin's books.
Yeah.
Called The Earth Chronicles. Now, I've only read one of those books. The one I read was called Genesis Revisited, which isn't so much about Planet X, but it's quite an interesting book. And Sitchin sort of promoted this sort of idea of what he thinks is in the Sumerian cylinder seals, Sumerian tablets, where they talk of this...
this is his interpretation of the tablets, yeah? Correct, let's make that clear.
Correct. Yeah. Yes, correct. His interpretation of the tablets, where we've got this additional planet in the solar system. I think there were supposed to have been 9 or 10 planets, according to the Sumerians. And one of them was this, they called it a radiant planet. It gave off its own heat. And Sitchin identifies its orbit as being 3,600 years, a highly elliptical orbit, you know, reminiscent of some of the orbits of various comets that we see, which have highly elliptical orbits. And he said that his last passage, I think, was, quite a long time ago, probably before the alleged time of Christ and so forth. I made some, you know, judgment that if Sitchin was correct, then Planet X could be 500 years away, in other words, if you look at the time, depending on which time scale you choose. But the various stories have been saying for several years, since the Sitchin books became popular again, probably in the early 2000s, I think, is probably where I would point to as a resurgence of interest. And ever since then, they've been claiming that Planet X is on its way back, and they claim that NASA have tried to hide this. And one of the stories that's told is one that I first heard in the 1980s, whereby the IRAS probe, which was the infrared astronomical satellite, which was launched in 1978, 1979, maybe even 1980, around that time,
is that when there was that newspaper article where they had discovered Planet X?
They looked at the IRAS satellite data, and they thought that what they had seen was a distant planet. And they had this idea that looking at the orbit of this planet, it was way out near the Oort cloud, which is this supposed... I'm a bit more sceptical of stories of the Oort cloud than I was now, which is this sort of cloud of debris which is left over from when the solar system formed, according to the textbooks that you might read. And this is where all the comets come from. So the comets are disturbed by some external gravitational force.
This is beyond Pluto, beyond our solar system. It's different to the asteroid belt. Some people confuse the two.
Yeah, that's right.
This is beyond our solar system.
The Kuiper belt, isn't it? There's also the
Kuiper belt as well. That's separate to the Oort cloud, I think. I don't know what the distance between the two is, but the Kuiper belt is another distant part of the solar system, according to some textbooks that you'll read. The idea is that you've got a sort of rocks flying around randomly there, and if a passing planet comes near, you know, you get a force of gravity moving the rocks and asteroids, and they come crashing in towards our sun and to the Earth, and therefore what's disturbing this cloud is Planet X, you know, according to some theories. And this is what the IRAS probe allegedly discovered. And it had this 26 million year orbit, and that's what wiped the dinosaurs out, and there's these mass extinctions once every 26 million years. So that was the mainstream view. Planet X believers have tried to focus on this IRAS data, saying that yes, they discovered Planet X in NASA data in 1980 or something, and they've hidden it ever since, and they knew about this and they didn't want to tell anyone because it was going to cause all these cataclysms and blah, 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 blah. And I've had people sending me photographs of Planet X, you know, they can see there are two suns in the sky and all of this.
Yeah.
And you'll see these YouTube videos. But unfortunately, the ones that I've seen are totally wrong. The majority of them are lens flares, which is this effect where you get a reflection inside the optics of a lens. when you take a picture. So that's quite, some people will say, oh, I never saw this object when I took the picture. I didn't see it with my naked eye. Well, the reason is, it's because you were looking through a camera lens to take the picture, or the picture was taken through a camera lens, and the optics of that are different to the optics of your eye. So you get multiple lens end elements, and you get lens flares and lens reflections in the with a very bright object reflecting into the darker parts of the picture. And it's very, very common. And the other one that comes up is sun dogs. These are, or false sun. And these are atmospheric effects, which are seen at an angular separation of 22.5 degrees from the disk of the sun, which is caused by the way that light refracts through ice crystals in cloud under certain conditions, and you get a second sun which looks like a weird sort of rainbowy type effect. And I've got I got an amazing one picture of one of these in 2003 from my back garden. I think it was 2003 2004. Extremely bright. I've never seen one so bright in that. I got one then, and it's very unusual if you don't know what you're looking at. Only usually lasts for about 10-15 minutes, and then it goes away. And the thing is that if you have any large planets like this, they would be there the next day. You would see them the next day, or yeah, you know, the next morning. These are not something. It's not going to be transient in the way that, say, you know, shooting star is transient. You can see comets, for example. I photographed a comet 2 or 3 years ago. Comet Lovejoy, I think it was called. And I actually managed to just get a photograph of that with a fairly simple setup. But the problem is that people don't know much about astronomy, or don't know enough about astronomy when they're talking about Planet X.
Yeah.
And
there is a theory that we're living in a, this sort of links to Planet X, that we're living in a binary star system, and that we have two suns. And some people are saying that Planet X is this red dwarf that's right, within our, you know, within the boundaries of our solar system, and that's what they're seeing.
Correct. Now, this goes back to the IRAS story as well. That was one of the versions or theories that was sort of put forward as a result of this IRAS data, the spotting this unusual object a long way off, which I think turned out to be a quasar, actually, which was giving off a lot of radiation and was later sort of re-identified. But the problem with the Planet X stories is, I mean, people say, oh, NASA hides data. Andrew, you've just said, you know, the Apollo missions were fake. That means NASA hides data. Yes, I think NASA does hide data. And I think they did fake the Apollo missions to a very large degree. Maybe not completely. You know, I think maybe the rockets did go up and take the astronauts into orbit. But they don't fake everything. And you can check that they don't fake everything by looking with your own eyes. I, for example, have looked through a telescope and seen the red spot on Jupiter, you know, with a telescope with my own eyes. I've seen the rings on Saturn with a telescope with my own eyes. So I know that those things are real.
Yeah, most of them, most people don't know. Most of NASA's archives are actually available online. I've actually looked through.
Yes.
You can search for keywords like Planet X, Nibiru. And there are a few documents where research scientists have studied Planet X and such, which I've read, so I know a little bit about this based on what NASA, you know, the NASA's own research on their own website.
Right. I mean, that's a good sort of thing to look at. I haven't looked particularly at those documents. What I'm more interested in this particular case is the amateur astronomy scene. Now, there are thousands of amateur astronomers around the world, and what they do every single night is they look for comets, because, you know, I'm a bit of a computer nerd, you know, and I'm interested in sort of some of the latest tech and gadgets and retro games and retro computing and all this stuff, you know. It's just a bit of a pastime when I'm not looking at this kind of stuff. And some people are interested in comets and finding comets, you know, and this sort of thing. And if you find a comet before anybody else does, you can go into an astronomical catalogue and get it named after you. Recent examples I think Comet Elenin was one like that, that was named after somebody or after somebody's wife or something. And then we had, what was the other one? I'm trying to think. I think maybe it wasn't Elenin. there was another one as well. I'd have to get the name of it up. And basically, if you have the right equipment, which is a fairly decent sized telescope, you'll need a 10-inch reflector or something bigger than a 10-inch reflector, 10, 12, 15-inch reflector. You need a CCD on the end of it and a camera and some special mount such that the telescope can be moved to a certain position in the sky. You need a computer to control the telescope and something to record the images from the CCD onto your computer. And then you can literally run some software and get the telescope to look at objects night by night and find which ones have moved. And you can pick up supernovae and novae and comets and other objects. And these amateur astronomers, if they can pick up objects which are quite faint. In fact, they can pick up comets out near the orbit of Jupiter. Now, a comet is typically something like 10, 15, 100 miles across, maybe, something like that. 100 miles across is a pretty big comet. Most of them are a lot smaller than that. And you can go and look this up. There's a website. I should try and get some of these names up for people to look at. There's a website where you can go and look at this, and they collect the number of minor planets found per month, and they have a whole database listing them all. The IAU Minor Planet Center, that's the name of it. It's called minorplanetcenter.net, and they will give you statistics about the number that they've discovered. I've got some statistics from 2013 when I was last looking at this, and they discovered 352 minor planets in 1 month. 352 in one month. Mm. Three comets were discovered that month, 56 in the last 12 months between 2012 and 2013. And there are 7.9 million observations in 2013. These are all on the Minor Planet Center. Nothing to do with NASA. This is the International Astronomical Union. So my point is, if you can see an object out to the orbit of Jupiter, which is 400 million miles, which is only 10 miles across, if you get something the size of the moon coming into the solar system, these people are going to see it. They're going to see it pretty quickly. And yeah. It's going to be all over their websites and Facebook pages. Forget whatever NASA wanted to do. They would not be able to shut that down.
Yeah, well, some people are saying that Planet X can't be seen for the visible spectrum because you need an infrared telescope to be able to see it.
Some of these have advanced equipment, and that is also slightly bogus because most of these objects are quite dark. And the ones that are of any size, sometimes you can spot them by what's called occultation, which is where the object goes in front of another object. That is indeed how the invisible, at the time, rings of Uranus were discovered in 1977. They couldn't see them visually. They actually measured them using a light meter, which measured the drop-off of the light as a star passed behind Uranus, and that's how they found the rings. And then they were later obviously photographed by the Voyager probe about 10 to 12 years later. So again, if people want to believe in Planet X, they can, but if they want to look at the evidence for Planet X being anywhere near the Earth, there is, as far as I can tell, no evidence of it being anywhere near the Earth. Mm. There are a number of objects that have been discovered out in the distant solar system in recent years. The two or three that I came across, let's see, I've got their names here. One was called Eris. One was called Makemake. And there's another one or two as well. So these objects have been discovered. Sedna was another one. That was, I think, for a period of time said to be Planet X. These things are way out beyond the orbit of Pluto, 5 or 6 billion miles away. So it's, you know, it's on the websites. You can go and look. It's not just NASA. It's other people that have looked into this as well. And I've put all this together in a presentation called Comets, Calamities, and Planet X. And there's, I found out quite a lot of interesting stuff about comets, about the false information that's been put out about comets as well. So if people want to check out that presentation, it's on YouTube, and I think it's on Daily Motion and Vimeo and things. So anybody that wants any of this information or further details, please do write to me. Just go on to checktheevidence.com, click the contact button, and if you've got a question about anything that I've discussed tonight, or you know, anything you find on the website, I will answer your question as best as I can.
Yeah, I'll put your contact details on the YouTube video once I've posted that after the show.
Thanks.
There's another question I wanted to ask you. It's about, sort of links to Planet X, about the South Pole Telescope. Mm. I don't know if you know anything about the South Pole Telescope, but it's sort of been people. And this, my question is really, is why would you build a telescope in one of the most unhospitable sort of environments on the planet, unless you're looking for something in particular? What do you think they're looking for?
Well, yeah, again, that's, you know, somewhat exaggerated, I think. I don't actually know if they've got a set of telescope at the South Pole or not. It's not a story I've properly checked into.
They do have a website. They do have the South Pole website. They do have a website. I've seen pictures of the actual
telescope. It's actually at the South Pole, or is it on, it's on the continent of Antarctica?
It's on Antarctica, yeah. I don't know. Okay. I don't think it's actually at the South Pole. It's sort of
just nearby.
I think it's probably a few hundred miles away from the actual South Pole. It's not like exactly at the South Pole, but it's in that region, yeah.
Okay, well, the reasons that you would build one there is because of the clear skies. It is also higher, you know, it's high up as well. I think it's something like 10,000 feet, I think, isn't it? The parts of the Antarctic continent, which is very high. So you're going to have very clear skies.
You can have clear skies in like Peru, South America, places
Of course.
Yeah, it's much easier to build a telescope there.
Of course. So I'm not sure why they'd want to build it there, but of course, let us not forget, we've been talking about a secret space program.
Right.
Let me tell you a little story, which is about the Hubble Space Telescope.
All right.
Now, when that was first sent up, there was apparently a conversation in a bar, because the Hubble Space Telescope initially had a bit of a problem in that it wobbled. And that was due to the uneven heating of the solar panels, because there was a slight uneven heating when it was in sunlight. It would introduce a slight wobble, which would affect the images. This was, of course, before the problems with this Duff mirror were found. There was a conversation in a bar where somebody who was on the design team or the management team for the Hubble Space Telescope was talking to somebody who worked on military spy satellites, and they said, oh, you should have come and talked to us about that. We had that same problem with our space telescopes, because of course the Hubble Space Telescope wasn't the first space telescope. It was just the first space telescope that was pointing away from the Earth. so
yeah,
you know, I mean, yeah, there could be a telescope at the South Pole. So what? They could have built it to look at something in particular down there. But they've got space telescopes already. They've had spy satellites for years. So they've got space telescopes pointing wherever they want them to, so they can get crystal clear pictures from space, and they go straight into black programs. I mean, I think it's as simple as that. So all this talk of the South Pole telescope, I think it's just not even worth, you know, discussing, really, because I think it's meaningless. Whatever that's discovered, they have far better pictures from space.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've heard stories that the Hubble Space Telescope doesn't exist. I don't know if you know a channel called Crow777. He does a lot of stuff on the moon. He had a guy on a while back now, maybe last year, and this guy actually called the team in charge of the Hubble Space Telescope, pretending to be a student researching a new project. And he asked them a whole load of questions about the Hubble Space Telescope. They couldn't answer half of them. And the guy he was speaking to was the guy who was in charge of the actual telescope. The telescope has no live feed, so they have no live images. There's no maneuvering capability. So I don't know how they actually maneuver.
I don't think that's correct. There is a maneuvering capability. I'd have to listen to the interview, but This is very much sounding to me like a story to go along with and try and promote the flat Earth nonsense.
All right.
That's what it sounds like. Obviously, I may be speaking out of turn because I haven't heard the actual interview, but that's what it sounds like. Crow 777. Sorry.
Apparently, there's a project called, I think it's called Sophia. It's run by, I'm not sure if it's run by NASA or somebody else, but it's basically a telescope that's identical, if not more advanced, than the Hubble Space Telescope. That's inside a 747. And they're claiming that all the images that are coming from the Hubble Space Telescope are actually coming from the Sophia Telescope.
Okay, well, that sounds fairly ridiculous to me, but I haven't researched into this story. I mean, there's to get images from a 747, they wouldn't do it that way anyway. You know, it'd be far better to, because in fact there was another telescope that was sent up on a balloon. It was sent up, or they were going to send it up. I think it was actually sent up. They sent up a telescope on a balloon. And so if they were going to fake the Hubble Space Telescope, they would do it like that, not with a flying around on a plane.
Well, yeah, this guy claims that there's an organization, I can't remember what it's called, but it's older than NASA, and it records every object that's ever been sent into space. And for whatever reason, the Hubble Space Telescope isn't listed in that database.
Well, I think that sounds like a convenient story that whoever it is making it up. So, you know, it doesn't sound that likely. What I can say is that the Hubble Space Telescope images, since day one, it's been acknowledged that they basically Photoshop them. You know, they do process them. Now, of course, they will say that that's to enhance the colours or, you know, enhance the contrast to bring out certain objects. But some, you know, many of them are composite images and stuff, and they don't make that immediately obvious. So it's certainly true that the Hubble images, you know, are not what you'd just see if you stuck your head outside the atmosphere, you know, with a zoom lens or something. You know, you wouldn't see what Hubble sees because they're digitally and optically processed in various ways. That much is true.
Mm.
But, for example, certain space images you can verify. For example, there was a storm on Saturn in 2010, a huge storm, you know, almost as big as the size of the Earth. And there were pictures taken by amateur astronomers which show the same as the pictures that came back from Cassini. So I'm sorry, folks. You know, I think you might have to accept that some of the space program is real and some of it is fake.
Right.
That's my current understanding of things, anyway, from the evidence that I've been looking at.
I think it's difficult to tell sometimes with the amount of disinformation that's
it is put yes. out there. Yeah, but many of these people that are putting out the disinformation don't have a very good knowledge of astronomy, and they haven't done their own observations. They're going off websites and rumors and YouTube videos, you know, and so forth. And it doesn't take a lot to get people to believe in a lot of disinformation. I've written a whole book about that, so in relation to 9/11, so I think I probably need to write another one.
Okay, I want to move on to our next subject, which is the pyramids.
Mm.
Now, when we talk about the pyramids, I'm not just talking about the pyramids like in Egypt, but the pyramids all over the Earth, and pyramids that have been found on Mars as well, and the pyramids that have been found also on the moon and possibly even on other planets. First of all, I wanted to ask you, what do you think the pyramids in Giza are? What were they constructed for? I know they're not tombs. You know, I mean, they say they're tombs. And how were they constructed, if you want to get into that?
Well, yeah, it's not something I've done a massive amount of research on, so I'm not a particularly good person to ask that question.
But what do you think the pyramids were built for? What was their purpose?
I would give a lot of credence to Christopher Dunn, because he's got a background in engineering. He's been there. He's measured a lot of the dimensions within the pyramids and the various features around the site and the other sites. And his book is actually called Giza Power Plant. Mm. And I think it is quite possible and indeed probable that perhaps I wouldn't necessarily use the word power plant, perhaps something like an energy conduit or an energy management system. That's perhaps what the pyramids were. And they may have something to do with resonance with Earth energies, because there appear to be encoded within the pyramids certain ratios to do with the Earth and the Moon. and obviously the relationship that many people have come across to Orion's Belt, where the three pyramids at Giza appear to be aligned with the stars in Orion's Belt, as was they were about 10,000 years ago. There's been a slight relative movement between the stars in Orion's Belt in the last 10,000 years, so it doesn't quite match the three pyramids at Giza now, I think. And that was talked about by Robert Bovall, but actually before that it was talked about by Desiree and J.J. Hertak, and not a lot of people know that. They also noticed that alignment before Robert Bovall started talking about it. So he was the one that's being credited with it, and then, of course, Graham Hancock picked it up. So I think it's something to do with that. The way that the pyramids are situated, I think, as I understand it, it's the centre of all the world's landmass, I think. If you average out the sort of landmass area, I think the pyramids are in the centre. So I do think it's got something to do with power generation. How they were constructed, I think there must have been some type of advanced technology involved, because when you start to look at the precision, obviously, is the obvious one, and also the movement of the blocks, some of which were extremely heavy. I don't think that was all done with ramps and counterweights and rollers, and, you know, I think they must have used either some type of anti-gravity technology or something. The other thing which I've come across but haven't researched thoroughly is that some of the blocks were actually poured. You know, they were poured and set, you know, like concrete.
Right.
I can't remember where I read that, but that was something which came up. But, you know, they used to be covered with a marble facing. They had a capstone, allegedly a gold capstone.
Yeah, I think one of them was white, one was red, and was one of them black, something like that, kind of black.
Oh, really? I hadn't heard that. I heard that they were all coated in marble, but white.
Yeah,
marble.
Different colour. Yeah, different coloured marble.
They were different colours, were they? I hadn't heard that before. But, yeah, and so there's Christopher Dunn's book. That, I think, would be an interesting one for people to read if they haven't read it yet. It's a book I need to read. I've only heard Chris Dunn talking about his book in some detail.
My understanding of the pyramids is because the way they're constructed and the where they're constructed on what you would call, I guess, grid lines or ley lines, that they actually harness the energy from the Earth. These what you call zero-point energy, which Tesla talked a lot about creating energy out of nothing. And the positioning of all the pyramids, not just in Egypt, but in South America and all around the world, connects to a grid system, an energy system of the Earth, and it harnesses that energy. The pyramid has a unique shape, from what I understand, in the way it's, you know, if you construct something using that shape, you can harness the energy of the Earth using that particular...
This is a peculiar thing. I mean, you know, they had the whole thing in the 70s with pyramid power, and people have repeated that since, and there does seem to be something in it. You know, it's certainly not something I can write off as some kind of New Age sort of cult type thing. You know, there's definitely something going on. And as you said, you know, I think it is really quite intriguing to me that we've had more pyramids being discovered, as you said, in China. You know, I wasn't aware of that until maybe 7 or 8 years ago is when I first heard of these pyramids in China. There are some more that I came across recently. I mean, there's obviously the ones in Mexico as well. The Bosnian ones, are interesting. I still haven't totally made my mind up on that, but it's certainly an interesting sight there that they've got. Graham Hancock doesn't believe that they're real, you know, structured pyramids, but I don't know what to think at this point. But so there was that, and there were some other ones that were discovered as well, and I can't remember where. Somewhere like Indonesia or somewhere like that.
Possibly, yeah. I know there's some in Russia.
Maybe it was Russia.
Yeah, but it does make you think, like, I mean, the pyramids are, what, 3,500, 4,000 years old, and to think that pyramids were being built all over the world by civilizations who had no communication between themselves,
yes,
they all managed to construct, you know, pyramids. It's a weird one, isn't it, really?
It is. You know, you do sort of think about it. You wonder if it's a sort of leftover technology from a global, you know, civilization. Yeah. And then it was, you know, the people have said that the Sphinx, for example, Robert Schock's analysis of the Sphinx makes it at least, I think, at least 5,000 years old.
I think they probably are all much older than...
Yeah, and I've heard as old as 10 or 20,000 years old.
I think even places like Stonehenge, I think they've dated it completely wrong. I mean,
I've spoken
to Maria Wheatley about that, and she says it's much, much older than... I think they say it's 5,000, 6,000 years old, but it could be anything up to 20,000 years old.
Well, I don't know. I'm not...
I think things like carbon dating are... not particularly reliable.
No, I know they're not always reliable. That's true. Yeah. And the other dating methods have their own problems as well. So, you know, I mean, there is certainly other possibilities that other than the ones that are accepted. And I think certainly with the pyramids, it's almost a joke. The official story of the pyramids, it really is. So, you know, I definitely say that the official story is a joke with the pyramids. I haven't studied Stonehenge as much, but could be the same story if they're wanting to suppress certain types of knowledge that would be associated with, you know, with a knowledge of what Stonehenge was really all about, you know.
Yeah, Stonehenge now, apparently not allowed to touch any of the stones.
No.
They give some stupid reason, you know, like about damaging them, but it's actually, you know, I think Maria Wheatley explained it, that you can actually channel energy at Stonehenge. So if you do touch the stones, you know, you get like a it's hard to explain really, I guess, but you get like a connection, you know, to
you could another book for readers to look at is Seed of Knowledge, Stone of Plenty by Kaj Halberg and John Burke. That's got information about what he thinks the stone monuments are for. And it's to do with fertility of agriculture. And there's some very good arguments in there and investigation with instruments to look at the electrical potential for these stone sites, you know. So I'd recommend people look at that if they want to. Yeah, and we you know, you mentioned the pyramid on Mars or pyramids on Mars.
Yeah.
And... you know, I remember watching the Doctor Who story. I think it was 1974. It was called that, the Pyramids of Mars, Pyramids of Mars, and it was a fascinating Doctor Who story. Anyone that's a fan of that show, it's got to be one of the best stories. And you know, I just thought it was a Doctor Who story. And yet, when we looked at the Viking pictures and the later Mars Global Surveyor pictures from the 1990s and 2000s. And I've done a bit of a presentation on some of this, not in huge detail, but salient points. You've got this so-called DNM pyramid, which was a five-sided pyramid, which is in the NASA pictures, and it's very unusual. It's very unusual that you would have this at that place near this alleged face, you know, structure, which is also very unusual. And so are we seeing the echoes of or the remnants of a civilization that was there, which then came to the Earth and built pyramids here? Or indeed, was it the other way around, you know?
Yeah.
And again, one of Stephen Greer's disclosure witnesses says that I think he was called Dr. B, I think, or something. I can't remember. There's a you can hear his discussion on YouTube, actually, because he released all those videos. And he said that a race of beings came from Mars 45,000 years ago, and they came from Mars to the Earth. And he said that they built the face on Mars, you know. And I found that quite interesting. So maybe there is a commonality, and the thing that some people have pointed out is that Mars has a 25-hour day, 24.9 hours is the length of the day on Mars. And if you take an ordinary person and put them in, a sort of windowless room, give them food and water and entertainment, but no clocks or nothing that allows them to keep track of time, after a few days they will go into a 25-hour sleep-wake cycle, not a 24-hour sleep-wake right. cycle.
Yeah, so our natural rhythm is in tune with Mars, isn't it?
Yes,
it's extraordinary.
Yes.
It's extraordinary. I was going to ask you as well your opinion on these Nazca aliens that they found. Do you find that's disinfo?
Well, I don't know about any Nazca aliens. Is this the recent one, do you mean, or...?
Yeah, they look like Plaster of Paris.
That one. Yes. I looked at that. This came out about, it came out about 3 or 4 weeks ago, didn't it? It was all over Facebook.
Yeah.
And the first picture that I saw of that was, I thought, nah, that just looks, I think I had exactly the same thought as Eunice. It looks like Plaster of Paris to me. And it also involves Jaime Massan, who I think has put out some interesting videos and stuff, but he's also been associated with a number of hoaxes that have been funneled through him. I think this thing is a hoax, looking at the way it's been promoted. It also got into the Sun and the Express in the UK newspapers, which is never really a good sign in my books.
Yeah, I agree. I want to move on to our final topic, which is the secrets of the solar system.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, I mean, we've been sending probes out into the solar system for a while now. And my thinking is if they did really find anything of any interest, they wouldn't tell us anyway. And the images that they send back are ludicrously low resolution. To be honest, ridiculous, some of the images that they send back from Jupiter and Saturn and even Pluto. And do you think that they're hiding something from us with regards to maybe there is another civilization living within our solar system or something else that they may be hiding from us?
I definitely think they are hiding stuff. I've come to that conclusion. Well, I came to that conclusion, I should say, about 13 years ago. And it was, we always started talking about it with the pyramids on Mars and stuff. And it was really from that point forward that I began to look for other stuff. And the particular one, which is you'll see it on my Skype picture, which is this dome in the middle of a crater. People have tried to say that, oh, this is a plasma feature caused by an electrical discharge under the Electric Universe model of planet formation, which I don't think it fits. I don't think it fits. This dome doesn't fit with that. I do think the Electric Universe is really pretty much correct, but I don't think it explains this dome, particularly because there are a number of other features near this dome, but not anywhere else on the planet, which share these features. I actually wrote to a geologist about this particular image back in 2004, and he wouldn't comment. I've got this in a presentation called Secrets in the Solar System, if anybody wants to watch that. That's also on YouTube. So there was this one, this dome image. There is also a T shape, which looks like a giant T, which is about 3 miles long. That's on Mars as well. There is another one which looks like an exclamation mark, and it's reminiscent of a Japanese kofun, which I found on another website sometime. So there's that one.
Did you see the one with the lights coming from, was it Ceres?
Yes, there's that one. That is also very peculiar. I don't think that was ever satisfactorily explained. We never really got to know what that was. So I don't know what that was. So there was that one. Phobos, which is the moon of Mars, that's also very unusual. A paper about the moon of Phobos was published in 2008, or rather a letter in either Planetary Science or Geophysical journal. And they had done a study of the radar data, which came back from Mars Express, which is the European Space Agency probe. And they said that the data which came back from the Mars Express probe tended to show that Phobos had large voids inside it. In other words, it was hollowed out. And they said that this was inconsistent with a captured asteroid theory. So in other words, Phobos wasn't a captured asteroid. And it's also very close to Mars. It's only 5,000 miles above the surface. Our moon, for example, is around about 230,000 miles away from the Earth's surface. Phobos is 5,000 miles, so it's very, very much closer and has a much more rapid orbit in that, or much, you know, shorter orbit for that reason. So Phobos is definitely an enigma. Another one which Richard Hoagland had pointed out, although I could tell a story or two about that, is the moon of Saturn called Iapetus, which is extremely unusual and is half dark, half light. It's been known about since the 17th century when it was discovered by Cassini with his small telescope. And it was seen to appear for 40 days and then disappear for 40 days because it had this black side and a white side which are turned alternately towards and away from the Earth. So
isn't there also a moon that looks like the Death Star from Star Wars?
Yeah, this analogy was drawn by Hoagland. Yeah, it's extremely peculiar if you look at the images. There's also Mimas is one that even looks more like the Death Star, and Iapetus bears some resemblance to it as well if looked at from a certain angle. And it's got this unusual equatorial wall which is about 8 miles high.
Yeah.
And it runs around about half the moon right along the equator.
It looks basically like someone's sort of stuck two halves together, kind of thing. Like,
It does indeed. It's extremely. NASA have never really commented on this. I mean, they made a video about the findings of Cassini. It was about, I think, about 20 minutes long. It's called Lord of the Rings, I think, or Rings. No, Ringworld. Ringworld it's called. It's not Lord of the Rings. It's called Ringworld. You can find this on NASA's website. Mm. And they have 1 minute on Iapetus, and it doesn't, you know, it tells you nothing, you know.
Yeah.
So they are definitely hiding some serious stuff. They really are hiding some stuff. I've no doubt about that.
Even like the Mars lander, I can't remember what it's called, you know, the one that's
like him.
Yeah. I mean, even a lot of the images coming from that, I don't really know how real they are.
Well, this is it. So this is another problem, you know, how you try and differentiate. Because, of course, Richard Hall and myself talked about this. Richard did an investigation with Douglas Gibson and regarding the, you know, what was in the lander images and looking at if these landers really could have got there.
Yeah,
I never really questioned this until fairly recently. I assumed the landers had got there and landed okay and everything. But Richard really was one of the first people to point out to me is that if you look at the Mars images and you reprocess them, I mean, most of the images that you're getting, even from the latest rover, which is called Curiosity, which landed in 2012, are in black and white. The majority of the images are still in black and white. They will occasionally put out some colour ones with a sort of orangey sky. But a chap called Holger Isenberg, he took the original Viking images, which allegedly came from Mars in 1976, and he reprocessed these images because they have a red, green and blue component, RGB, which is the colours that make up the LEDs on your monitor now these days. He reprocessed those images and came out with Martian images with a blue sky. Now, I thought that might be because Mars really did have a blue sky and they were trying to cover up the fact that it was similar to the Earth. But another conclusion is that rovers aren't on Mars, they're on Earth. That's why the sky is blue.
Yeah.
Then you start to look at, for example, the way the landers landed. Similar problem with the Apollo. What about the fuel? You know, when the Apollo craft got to the moon, it would have been traveling, you know, 10,000 miles an hour or something. And to slow a craft down to a point where you can land it, you've no atmosphere on the moon, so you have to use chemical rockets to slow the thing down. You know, you need quite a lot of fuel to change the velocity down to a low enough level to actually land.
Yeah.
Same problem on Mars, except you've got a little bit of atmosphere. But I think the early probes didn't. They were claiming that they would use parachutes to take off a lot of the, speed.
Velocity, yeah.
But if you're a skydiver on Earth and you open your parachute too early above 15,000 feet, the air is too thin and the parachute doesn't open properly.
Yeah.
On Mars, the atmosphere is 10 or 100. I forget the factor, but it's either 10 or 100 times thinner. And they claim to have opened the parachute at, 40,000 feet or something. I can't remember, but you can find this information. And when you start to think it over, you think, so you're landing this Curiosity rover, which has a ton, it weighs a ton, it was as big as a car, with this parachute that's not going to open. Are you really going to be able to do that? Are you really going to be able to slow this down when it's been traveling 10,000 miles an hour, 5,000 miles an hour, whatever?
It doesn't add up.
Potentially it doesn't.
The show's going to finish any minute now. Do you want to give out your contact information again for people who are listening?
Sure, yes. You can contact me through checktheevidence.com, through the contact page. My email address is on there too. And maybe my telephone number's on there as well. But I generally like the calls go on to an answering machine because so get so much spam. But you contact me and I'll try and answer your questions.
Okay, well, it's been great talking to you. Is Nyssa still there?
Hi, can you hear me?
I can still hear you.
I keep going. My mic keeps working and not working, but it's been absolutely excellent, Andrew. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, there were a few other topics I wanted to cover, but maybe we can have you back on at some point and talk about some other topics. It's been very interesting talking to you this evening, especially the stuff about the secret space program. It's a topic that I've been looking into for a number of years, and I've learned a few new things this evening. So thanks for coming on. I can hear the music coming in now.
Great, thanks for inviting me.